He did not tell Gandalf, but as he was speaking, a great desire to follow Bilbo flamed up in his heart. To follow Bilbo, and even perhaps to find him again. It was so strong that it overcame his fear. He could almost have run out there, and then down the road without his hat, as Bilbo had done a similar morning long ago. The Shadow of the Past. Today on The Great Company, we continue our book club series with the first two chapters of Book One. Though the saga expansions are past this point in the text, the opening chapters were rather untouched by the game. Are there any cards to be found in long-expected parties in Shadows of the Past? Also, we recap Gen Con experiences. Stick around.
It is the Great Company Podcast. I'm Derek, and thank you for joining us on this, our second installment of the book club series. And thank you to those of you who participated as well on Facebook and beyond. Joining me is the full Great Company. Dan, how are you, sir?
I'm doing okay. Had a chance to do a four-player game of Ruins of Belagost at the store this last week, and it was a blast. So
awesome.
Yeah, it's fun to finally actually play some of the new scenarios. I didn't have as much time to play them at Gen Con as I would have liked.
Sure. It is surprisingly busy for a leisurely game convention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also joining us is Ian. How are you?
I'm good. Just trying to stay cool, although I think I have the least cause to complain out of the four of us living
Maybe.
In California.
I guess we could go up on AccuWeather and compare and just whine about it, but...
But I'm good, you know, getting a little bit of LOTR, not as much as I'd like, and playing a bit of the new Game of Thrones on Octagon as well. So
nice. Are you, you're House Stark, aren't you?
No, I've been playing a lot of, surprisingly, I've been playing a lot of House Tyrell, which I would not expect.
Interesting.
They were the first house that actually let me win a game, so I have a little bit of loyalty to that.
That's always disappointing when your thematic preferences don't line up with your gameplay preferences.
Yeah.
Anyway. Speaking of gameplay preferences, what's up, Matthew?
Not too much. I, as well, have not been able to play really anything since Gen Con, so just busy, busy, busy with work, as always.
And busy reading, I hope.
Sure.
Good answer. That's the right answer. Awesome. Well, before we dig deep into the Red Book, though, I am going to debrief these gentlemen on how their Gen Con experience was this year, since I myself did not go. So let's start with our listener event. So Dan, why don't you get us started here? How did the draft go?
It was awesome, actually. Matt Newman was one of the eight that participated, so that was
awesome.
Really cool. I particularly enjoyed, there was one point when someone was saying something about, like, one of the, you know, like, why did you include such and such a card in the draft pool? That card's underpowered. And I was like, I don't know, talk to him. It's just funny. But, no, it was a lot of fun just to watch, you know, just to, I'd only ever done it with four or six in Austin. We haven't had a chance where we've had all eight there at this, you know, people there at the same time to do it, so... Being at Gen Con and getting to see, you know, and we actually did it with teams like I, you know, had intended on the blog of actually it's like kind of a semi, it's cooperative but then semi-competitive because each of the teams played Weather Hills easy mode, which is still brutally hard.
Yeah.
And then they compared score at the end and scores at the end and it was actually really close. I think the winning team won by like, I don't know. Less than 10 points or something, I want to say.
Yeah, what were the team names?
There was Double for Gondor, because Matt Newman's deck was pretty epic. He was able to like basically draft all the Gondor cards, which was pretty awesome. And then the other one, what was the other team name? I think I posted it on Facebook. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, but, I can't remember off the top of my head.
I'll have to go look it up.
It was funny. That's why I asked about Double for Gondor, and I can't remember the other one either. We'll have to. I'll splice it in later.
Yeah, we'll have to splice it in. But yeah, it was honestly, I think my favorite part of it all. Like, you know, I was not one of the participants. I basically just ran it and made sure everyone, you know, had what they needed. But just watching people draft this game is really fascinating, you know, because you'll see like the different decisions as people are drafting heroes and then as they're drafting different cards. And he's pretty active on the forums, Matthew John Elliott, Elias,
oh, yeah.
Elias, how Elias, his name yeah, yeah. is, was one of the guys drafting, and he was able to draft a deck that honestly looked like it was constructed because he just went straight Hobbits. It was Spirit Frodo, Pippin, and Spirit Merry. Lore Pippin and Spirit Merry, and the deck was just amazing, and it was really cool to see because, you know, it's one of the things that can happen in draft is, like, no one else is taking any of the Hobbit-related cards because, you know, as Matthew will tell you, they all suck.
Which is true.
So when you make a deck of, when you're able to draft all of them and you make a deck with that, it really ends up looking like a constructed deck, and it's pretty solid.
So is Newman cool taking the idea to Fantasy Flight organized play?
I don't know. I mean, he definitely mentioned specifically, he hung around a little bit afterwards and mentioned that he really enjoyed it. So that was cool to hear.
That's really that feedback. Very cool. Very cool to have designers that really, really do care. Not, you know, those of you who listened to our previous episode, Caleb gave us a great interview. Those guys really, really do care.
I mean, it's worth mentioning that Matt Newman was there, like, not with FFG. He was just there on his own and he chose to participate. So that was really cool that he could have been doing anything at Gen Con and he chose to come to the listener event. That was nice of him to do that.
So all of you got to attend the fellowship event. What are your guys' official takes on Ruins of Belagost here after you've had a couple weeks to digest?
Well, that's what I was playing when I was too cool to attend the listener event. it's a good quest. I feel like I heard some people say it's the best Gen Con quest yet.
Best as in beatable?
No, I didn't beat it, but it's just fun. It's like, it's interesting that we've got Escape from Mount Graham, which the release article Matt Newman's talking about, it was inspired by sort of video game RPGs where you get locked in a dungeon and lose all your stuff. In many ways, this one's kind of the same, in not that you lose all your stuff, but that you're trying to find treasure and you're adding objectives, attachments that are pretty cool and fun and can help you take a different path if you get the right one at the right time. And I don't know, it's a fun quest. I mean, I haven't played it since, but I think we played it twice and lost. But the way the boss enemies come in and out of play is interesting because it's different. So I don't know if I'm ready to say it's the best Gen Con quest, but it's probably definitely in the running, at least as far as interest and replayability and just being different than all the others. So is it hard? Yeah, but is its only goal to smash you over the head? No, I thought it was more interesting than that.
Yeah, I haven't actually gotten a chance to play it since Gen Con, unfortunately, but I do remember enjoying it, even though we lost, because we made a crucial play mistake at some point, which Caleb later pointed out, and then we're like, well, we're not going to be able to trace back our steps, like, two turns and redo everything. But generally, I had a good impression of the quest. I like that it has, you know, branching paths depending on what loot you pick up, so I'm looking forward to playing it again. The other team for the draft was Ride to Ruin, by the way. I looked it up. Team Ride to Ruin.
Team Ride to Ruin.
Yeah. I assume Ride to Ruin played a part in there because of that. I did want to mention at our listener event, while Dan was doing the draft, I got to run four players through one of my first stage quests, which was a lot of fun. Getting to see people experience, you know, something that I designed, it was a lot of fun, and they ended up losing. And I kind of, you know, I've heard Caleb say before he really enjoys when he sees players getting smashed. And I didn't quite understand it until I had the experience on my own end. Like, there was one turn where I knew there was a certain card in the deck that if they drew that, they would just get completely screwed. And there's a little voice in me just cheering on, like, draw that card. And then they drew it, and there was just, like, an evil chuckle, you know, just erupting from me, and I love that moment. But, yeah.
Well, we're going to be talking a lot about the lures of power tonight and the book club. Yeah, there's exactly. Definitely something to that with gaming. Like, when you're playing as DM, or even we had a little brief game of Descent at RangerCon at Dan's house, and even playing that, every time I rolled well enough to, like, take Matthew's dwarf out, I was like, yes, done it. That's funny. Hey, man, at least it wasn't Twilight Imperium.
Yeah, it's true. You know, for me, the highlight of Gen Con every year, oddly enough, isn't the gaming. And this year, I think that was particularly the case because there were no new games I was really dying to try or to demo. I mean, a Game of Thrones 2nd Edition I was semi-interested in, but other than that, there was really nothing new that I wanted to try, which in previous years I've always had at least one or two things I wanted to scope out. But Cardboard of the Rings did the After Dark party, and we were a part of that. And that was a lot of fun, because as easy as it is to get upset at people on the forums, and there was another whole tirade this past week on the forums about feminism and interesting thing, and, you know, Tolkien, and which always comes up, but two threads got locked in the forums this week. And it's really easy on the internet, I think, to get burned by people that are just disrespectful or rude, or, you know, certainly I've talked about this on the show before, and certainly in the progression series, we got a lot of flack from folks. But it's always heartening to hear people still ask about Mitch and I and the progression series and if it's ever coming back and how much they enjoyed it or it got them into the game. Or specifically at the After Dark, I had the chance to chat with Sean, who was a volunteer for FFG, and then Jason, who's just a listener. And it's always nice to get to talk to folks who just genuinely like what we produce and our insights on the game, and realize that not everybody out there is a troll, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny to talk. There, somebody told me, Matthew, I really didn't like you on the progression series, but you're okay on the Grey Company, which I wasn't sure how to take that comment phrase. But it was awesome. Nice to hear, you know. And I'll say, for full disclosure, one, I'm often having antioxidants when recording the Grey Company. And two, I feel like my job is to spice up the show, so you never actually know if what I'm saying is my real opinion, or more to play devil's advocate. But long story short, I also met a really cool guy named Tim, and we got to hang out with him a lot outside of some of the gaming events. So shout out to Sean, Jason, and Tim. But meeting listeners and meeting other fans of the game and hanging out with Caleb and Matt are really almost always the highlights for me, as opposed to just, you know, playing games or whatnot. So it certainly this year didn't disappoint in that respect.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, I'll second that I think one of the great things about Gen Con is if you are part of this particular card games community, that everyone kind of gets together at Gen Con. You know, there's a lot of people who told me, you know, that this was their first time coming, and I would see them later on, like, hanging out with other people. And, you know, basically what I would say is, if you're thinking about coming to Gen Con and you're part of this community, but you're worried, like, oh, I'm just coming by myself, I don't know anyone, you shouldn't worry about it, because the community's pretty tight, you'll meet people, and it'll be a good time, you'll find games easily and hang out, and it's pretty much like a big LOTR LCG reunion every year at Gen Con. So
yeah, the Cardboard of the Rings event, it seems like it gets bigger and bigger every single year, which is really awesome to see that many people playing the game at one time. And yeah, I mean, we hung out with Tim a lot, you know, he came to lunch with us a few times, you know, we text, he wants to play Octagon, you know, and stuff. So yeah, I mean, I definitely would echo what Ian's saying, is if you ever want to go, you will make new friends and be able to hang out and not be alone. So it was definitely a good time. And certainly thanks to the bar that hosted us. I'm forgetting the name, which is horrible, probably because I'm a few beers in. But
Twisted Noodle or something?
Twisted Noodle. Was that Slippery Noodle?
Slippery Noodle.
But it was a really cool place.
There we go. Yeah, I knew something noodle.
Yeah, it's been there since the 1800s. So thanks again to Slippery Noodle for hosting the great Cardboard of the Rings and us at the event. It was really nice to have the whole downstairs area to ourselves, where we could just be silly and wild and crazy, and it was lots of fun.
I also enjoy it was almost like being there, going through Brandon from Cardboard of the Rings picture feed.
Yes.
I think he just goes, I don't know if he even goes for gaming anymore. I think he's just smuggling like American junk food back across the border.
I think so.
He must have it shipped to himself.
As soon as I saw him, he was offering me like three or four different flavors of chips, poutine chips, and everything else. And I was like, oh God, Brandon.
But yeah,
it was great
Canadian
to see Brandon,
thing.
Of course, as always. He's such a riot. So, yeah.
He is a character. It was cool to meet Chris Schrock, I want to say, Lurkwood Runner.
Yeah.
That was another member of the community that I've interacted with online, and then getting a chance to meet him. And I'm sure there's other people as well. I'm sorry, I can't remember all of them off the top of my head right now. But yeah, it's just to echo what Ian said, it's very true that there's a real sense of community. I don't know if it's that it's a cooperative game or just the kind of people that this game attracts, but the community around it is really one of the best things. And Gen Con is probably the best example of that, I would say, because if you're a troll that just wants to live on the internet and spew garbage at people,
we're going to punch you in the face at Gen Con, so don't show up. So.
Well, that's what it comes down to.
Bringing that pain.
Everyone that I met was really cool. Both, like, all the people that participated, and I can't speak for Ian on the first stage stuff, but at least on the draft stuff, like, all the people that participated were really cool and just really nice, and I felt like everything just went smoothly, and it was such a breath of fresh air. You know, you get sometimes when you only have the internet as a as a medium to understand what's going on, and you see these, you know, all these huge flame wars on the forums, and people getting, you know, heated about just minutia or whatever, it gives you a certain kind of warped perspective. And then when you go to Gen Con and you get to meet people in person and really interact, you realize, like, no, there's a lot of really cool people here, and it's kind of not fair that we have the internet that makes things seem so out of, you know, like, it blows every little thing out of proportion, I guess.
Yeah. I don't think I've met a person in someone in real life that plays this game that I have not enjoyed playing the game with. So I agree. In many ways, I think the internet ruins everything. There's something about, you know, being anonymous and just, you know, whatever. We've had whole episodes or parts of episodes about this, and I could talk about it forever. But certainly the community is great. It was nice to meet lots of people. Whether we talked to them for 5 seconds or longer, it was certainly great to stay up till 5 o'clock in the morning with Ian and Dan and yeah, talk about stuff, you know, even though I was ready for bed. But it's always nice to see you guys as well. All right, I'm done being soft. Back to hating the game.
Let's do it. Let's forget the game. Let's hate this stupid book.
Ugh, I had to read Tolkien. Are you kidding me?
Ugh, disgusting.
Worst book ever written.
Telling you.
you slipping the curmudgeon pants back on, Matthew.
The one thing I'll say as a shout-out is someone said that our show was not funny enough. So, my goal this evening is
wackity schmackity do.
Here it comes.
Not funny enough.
I've been busting my butt with these three jokers for hours at a time. Just kidding.
I guess maybe we need to make a video podcast because we're all funny looking. So
there you go.
All it take is
we need to do that next episode. We're going to make it happen. All right. Let the book club begin. So previously, we had discussed the prologue, which is mainly concerning hobbits. But we were digging out a lot of interesting details out of there about hobbits and then about this almost meta perspective on the book. How, in a sense, it is not so much written as translated. Tolkien discovered the Red Book of Westmarch and translated it into contemporary English and this whole meta stuff. Getting into the book proper, book one of The Fellowship of the Ring, we actually get to the story itself, and it all begins with a long-expected party. And so it all starts with you know, the popular scene that's wonderfully portrayed in the films where we have the whole Shire, obviously the whole area of Hobbit and Bywater, and the whole West Farthing is all abuzz about the birthday party. And then indeed the whole Shire becomes very excited about it, because as we learn, in the time between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, Bilbo Baggins has become something of a celebrity, and that celebrity only increases after the party. But we also learn that for some reason or another, he has aged spectacularly well. Now, it is worth noting that Tolkien even said this in a letter, that a hobbit's kind of average lifespan would be about 100 if the average human's or man's lifespan is 80. So he's coming up on his 111th birthday, but he still looks as he did in his late 50s, or even early 50s, because he was 51 when he or just 50 when he came back from his adventures there and back again. So we already get some connection to the Hobbit, and we get some suspicion, a little bit of intrigue immediately. And then from there, it just progresses through Gandalf's arrival, the expectation of fireworks, and the big party itself. And I think it's easy for me as a reader to glaze over this chapter because it's very well done in the films, and I feel like I have this gallery of mental images to carry me through this chapter. But going back through this time, I tried to be very particular about keeping an eye on little details, and lots of little details popped up here and there. And I noticed this before, but I kind of passed it over, and I'm going to make that our first starting point tonight, if you guys will allow me, is towards the beginning of the party. And I'm skipping over some of the dialogue between Gaffer Gamgee and then later Sam Gamgee. Going straight. Well, we'll come back to that. But I wanted to bring this up lest I forget. It is the best part, which we'll get back to that.
Oh, then it's the worst.
You know what? I've had enough of you. When they get to it's not private because a gross of people were invited, but it talks about didn't actually highlight it because I should have. Okay, it talks about how their select guests come to this big party tent, which is kind of like the private VIP lounge, and it talks about the addition of a few special unrelated friends such as Gandalf. So that, and then coupled with the dwarves that pop out when Bilbo finally leaves Bag End, and the talk of other quote-unquote strange folk heading into Bag End, could there have been anyone else at the party besides hobbits and Gandalf? Like, could some dwarves have come and that weren't named? Could some men maybe from Dale have come? I was wondering if that popped out to you guys and if you had any thoughts on the situation.
I sort of thought that Tariel might have been there.
She should have been there. I hear she does good party tricks.
We need strong female characters at the birthday party.
That's true. Lobelia Sackville is not enough.
Oh, the trolling has begun.
you know, I honestly didn't think about it. I just, what got me the most was they kept talking about 33 being the coming of age, and I am 33 myself as of this year, so I felt a kindred spirit to Frodo.
I'm turning 33 next year, and I'm literally having a huge Hobbit coming of age party, so we're just going to save up Patreon money and fly you guys to Atlanta.
All right.
Sounds good. All right. as far as other people coming, I don't know. I guess I never thought about it, but I always thought it was interesting that the dwarves were there. I also picked up on that in this read, and obviously in the movie they weren't there unless they're hidden in the background.
They're,
and I
they're
never
all wearing
saw
rings.
Them,
they're
but,
invisible.
Yeah, they're the. But yeah, I assume some of the dwarves that are still alive from The Hobbit are there. I don't know if Bomber was part of it. I'm sure he would probably want to be at that party, right?
Yeah. But it's weird. Like, okay, so let's just skip ahead of these intriguing dwarves. Three of them pop out. First of all, it's at the end of this whole conversation with Gandalf like yelling at Bilbo and Bilbo yelling at Gandalf. It's like a domestic dispute. And then all of a sudden, like, these three dwarves pop out of these out of various rooms where, quote-unquote, they had been busy. So it's like they're just packing stuff and they don't hear Gandalf or Bilbo going at it. Like, oh, there they go again. We're just staying out of this one.
Well, you're just cringing in the corner.
Right. And then,
Mommy,
and, you know,
Daddy, stop.
But then it's like, which dwarves are they? Because if they were Biffer, Buffer, Bumber, they would have been named. So are these just some young dwarves that Bilbo somehow met as they were passing through the Shire? And he's like, hey, I need some muscle to get me down the road with F in case I get jumped by trolls again. Or is it even worth looking into?
I mean, they did mention in the party that there's some toys from Erebor, so maybe they're, like, delivery dwarves.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't know. Young delivery dwarves.
Delivery dwarves. So what is the custom? Do you tip a delivery dwarf? How does that work?
It would be insulting. You don't tip them.
It's like the new Amazon drones, just Middle-earth style.
So I mean, if we're going to speculate about which dwarves they were, assuming they weren't just random delivery dwarves, I don't think they could have been Balin, Ori, or Oin, just because of the timing.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they were dead at that point, but I think they had already left for...
They had, like, 10 or 20
Moria.
Years before that, yeah.
Right.
And certainly not, like, Dane, you know, King Under the Mountain. So, I mean, it would have had to have been lesser members of that group if it was any of them at all. I don't know.
That's kind of neither here nor there. But one thing I did like that I did have as an idea for card inspiration, because it is worth mentioning that the Black Riders, you know, this period of time is covered, but the Black Riders pick up 18 years after the party when Frodo finally leaves the Shire, so none of this stuff really gets picked up in the card game. But one thing I thought would be kind of cool, and I don't know if it would work, the term real dwarf make comes up when they talk about the prizes and the goodies coming for Bilbo to distribute, which is a great practice of hobbits distributing parties to their guests on their own birthdays, which might be worth thinking about here in America. But real dwarf make, I was thinking if that would be possible to almost like make an attachment to an attachment, so it would somehow, like, you have a shield or something, you attach real dwarf make to it, and all of a sudden it's like this new quality is revealed because it's an actually made by dwarves, so it would enhance it. I don't know how you could word that as a card, but I just love that phrase, real dwarf make. So I was trying to think of a way to incorporate that into the game somehow.
Yeah, I like the idea of an attachment, you know, showing the quality. And then the encounter deck could have, like, the shoddy knockoff attachment that attaches to your attachment.
Right, yeah. Real
makes
goblin
it
make.
Worse somehow.
But I guess
you thought that was Andaril. It turns out
it's actually an orc scimitar you found lying on the ground.
It's called Xandaril. And it doesn't hold its edge.
Oh, jeez. I guess that thing almost sounds more like a Boon Burden type of thing, which would fit with the Saga expansion. But
yeah, one thing this game doesn't have is what other games have, like permanent events. Events that you play that stick around forever, or at least extended periods of time. It could be something like that. I don't know. It's a cool idea, though.
Yeah, we'll see. Fireworks. Are fireworks worth including in the game?
Hmm.
I was wondering that, and then I started, although the times I've read the book, I never stopped to think about, like, the technology of fireworks and where they get that technology, and we don't see that kind of technology pop up anywhere else, really, except for Saruman, and then, so, yeah, maybe it's a wizard thing that they play around with the gunpowder and fireworks and stuff. I guess that makes sense. But as far as the game, I don't know. Would it break your immersion to, like, pop out a little squib or whatever?
It's yes.
Like, fired in the face of a goblin or something?
Dwarf candle.
Real dwarf make candle.
Yeah, I guess there'd have to be some kind of joke expansion for all this kind of lighthearted stuff, which is actually a criticism some people have of the first few chapters, because it's a lot of it is... Tolkien was very amused by the hobbits, and it was kind of a personal, you know, joke with himself is trying to make the hobbits as kind of goofy and rustic as possible. And so I think for someone, a nerd like me, it's wonderful because I'm a bit of an Anglophile and I could read a whole novel about Gaffer Gamgee. But for some people, it's not serious enough or it belies the tone of the book. But to me, it kind of transitions one from the tone of the Hobbit into the darker tone of the Lord of the Rings.
I also think it's necessary, just from a literary standpoint, not that I want to delve too much into the weeds here, but if it's, like, if you listen to any movie or TV commentary track, television writers always say, even in the darkest of dramas, you have to have lighthearted moments or that you lose the audience. In other words, audiences cannot take depressing, serious the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
I actually always wonder every time they say that, because every TV writer or movie script writer says this. I'm like, well, have we ever been tested to see if we can handle that? Because I can't think of anything that does. But with that said...
Game of Thrones?
Well, maybe. But even they have their lighthearted moments. Yeah. You know, they do. You have to relieve the tension in some ways, at least according to author. People above my pay grade. So I would say that in a way, for Sam and Frodo's journey to be worth anything, they have to start off sort of goofy to grow to be these, oh, I never thought you would have done this. So I would argue that anyone who says that these chapters are too lighthearted or superfluous really don't get the point or don't really understand the construction of literature, when that if they started off as super sort of serious, yes, I want to go on a quest and I've experience in this, the journey of the hobbits isn't quite as important as it might otherwise be.
Yeah, and I think it also shows the journey, right? Because we end with the scouring of the Shire and seeing what happened to the Shire, so you kind of need to see it in its, like, pure untainted form at the beginning.
Yeah, I totally agree about the narrative things that you guys are pointing out, and I don't think that's getting into the weeds at all. I mean, if we're going to talk about the books, we might as well talk about them as literature, and that's really what you guys are getting into, is that these things are not, I don't think that they're accidental. I think Tolkien's intentionally having this very lighthearted, kind of whimsical beginnings, but then it gets pretty serious pretty quickly, and that contrast in itself is meaningful. The one other thing that I want to add in terms of how the Hobbit seems so silly and even frivolous, I really think that, and it's also one of the reasons why I think Tolkien has this kind of fascination with the hobbits. I think that they represent his nostalgic view of the simple country folk of England, and the fact that he was in World War I and went through all the things that he did and saw the things that he saw. Like, he has a respect for these simple folk that when they're put in extraordinary circumstances, some of them end up being very brave, end up being heroes. Like, that, I don't think it's coincidental that he would have this very whimsical beginning to it, but then you throw them into the, you know, in some cases, literally into the fires and see what happens, you know. It's appropriate to me that the book starts off the way it does.
I think another thing that kind of, moving away from that question a little bit, but... something that has popped out more to me as I'm reading Lord of the Rings again, which I first heard from the Tolkien professor, who he talked about this, is how Bilbo himself kind of played like a mentor role for the next generation of hobbits.
Mm-hmm,
people
absolutely.
Like Frodo and Merry and Pippin. And I never caught that in earlier readings, but now reading this, I'm really looking for it. And it really stands out that's kind of... It's just really cool how everything fits together from The Hobbit to Lord of the Rings, because, you know, Gandalf picked Bilbo to go on this journey back when. But not only did he do all this stuff, like, you know, getting rid of Smaug in the end and all this kind of big geopolitical stuff that helped during the War of the Ring, but he also, by kind of turning Bilbo into the seasoned adventurer, he also... I'm talking about Gandalf here. He helped bring up a new generation in the Shire that would be ready for this next adventure, set of adventures. And, you know, I don't think of of Gandalf is this kind of like Peter Baelish from Game of Thrones figure who's like a master schemer who planned all of this in advance. But I think he had really good instincts and he had some insight into the future just because of, you know, being a Maia and where he came from. But I just think it's really cool that, you know, by Bilbo going that adventure, he basically, by telling all these stories to the young hobbits, helped prepare them for their adventures later on. So all that brings me to the idea that I think we're overdue for a new version of Bilbo.
Yeah.
And I think he should be a leadership Bilbo to reflect that he was a leader among those hobbits, not in a way we think of a conventional leader, but he was a mentor to them.
He's almost like a cultural leader, but I feel like I read somewhere that someone had stated, I don't remember if it was Matt or Caleb or maybe even a prior, hopefully it was a prior developer so that we can see a new Bilbo, but they'd said like that was it for Bilbo, the lore hero card, apart from the Baggins sphere. I hope that's not true, because I think, you know, in light of the revised Hobbits that started with Black Riders, Bilbo kind of got the shaft, so I would love to see him revised. But I can't find the specific reference, but it talks about how Mad Baggins, well, Bilbo was kind of like a champion of the poorer Hobbits to begin with, but then after that, after his disappearance after the party, Mad Baggins became even more of a legend and kind of a folk hero. And I love what you're saying about that, Ian. I think that's such a cool thing for Bilbo, and I made mention of this, I think it was one of the Master of Lore articles, about how in the very same chapter or the following chapter it talks about Gollum being drawn to Mordor and how all evil things are drawn to Sauron. So I thought it was cool that as a contrast to that, Bilbo drew all of these adventurous hobbits to himself, you know, whereas they otherwise might have been stymied by this kind of conservative society they were growing up in. They had a hero in Bilbo, so I think that was a very cool contrast between the two of them.
Yeah, it's really cool.
One other thing that we get lots of little glimpses of, if you pay special attention to it, is lots of insight into Gandalf's character. And you mentioned how he's definitely not a grand schemer like we would see in something more political, but he almost intuits his way into this stuff. For example, he says after Bilbo got the ring, Gandalf says that there was a shadow on his heart, though he didn't know why. So he kind of intuited that there was something wrong with the ring. Or there's another part where he says, where Bilbo says, "Oh, you're right, as usual." And Gandalf says, "Yeah, I am right when I know anything." So it's like the idea that when he does know what he's talking about, he really knows what he's talking about. And it's just, yeah, it's just like Matthew. One thing that's really interesting is how characters are introduced, but not really. And when we get to the Shadow of the Past, it's long exposition. It's long dialogue filling in all these gaps between Gandalf and Frodo. And it's very similar to the Council of Elrond, where it's this long diatribe of information that fills us in as readers, and it also informs the characters internally. And so on the one hand, Tolkien very much deliberates and belabors a lot of the information and makes sure that we understand what's going on. But on the other hand, there's a lot of brevity, because Frodo is going to be the hero of the story, and he's never properly introduced. At the beginning, it says that Bilbo adopted him and brought him to Bag End, and then the next time we see him, he's at the party after Bilbo disappears, ordering the wine to be passed around. Merry and Pippin, it's the same way. Merry is just, all of a sudden, he's there helping Frodo tidy up after all these, you know, relations and other hobbits have kind of sacked Bag End, which was a pun. And so these guys who are, and you know, Sam gets a little bit more of an introduction, but these hobbits who are going to be the whole crux of the story just kind of pop up. So I thought that was kind of interesting in how, on the one hand, Tolkien can be very generous with his information and descriptions, whereas on the other hand, these very important characters are just there. Whereas with other books, you might get a long introduction about them thinking about something or how they look or whatever. All of a sudden, in The Lord of the Rings, you just have these major characters appear.
Yeah, it's one of the things that makes me appreciate rereading it more. Like, it's one of the few books that I like more the more that the, you know, subsequent reads, is that characters like Pippin and Merry and Sam, you know, I'm sure that even the first couple times I went through and read Lord of the Rings, you don't really know anything about them. Like you said, you just dive right into the adventure with very little background on a lot of the characters, but it makes it so that the little moments, the little things that they do throughout the story become more important. It magnifies those decisions and those moments that they have. I just enjoyed being reminded of how much the hobbits love to eat. Because that is like a serious focus of the first entire book of the six books. Is it's just like every time there's a moment for him to point out the fact that they are very keenly aware of when they last ate and when they will next eat.
Yeah.
It's in there.
Yeah. And I love that Bilbo's party was literally just like 8 hours of eating. It says that they literally just ate the whole time. That's so good.
And that even the people that didn't even really like him showed up and, you know, wouldn't have missed it for the world because they knew it was going to be a huge feast
yeah.
and they were going to have a blast.
And even, like the reason why after Frodo's parents get married, they moved to Brandy Hall in Buckland. Not because it seemed like a good idea, but because the, I forget the name of the head of, what's his name? Whoever the old buck was at that time kept a good table.
I think another thing that popped out to me kind of along the same line of the food is this kind of a custom they have of giving away gifts on their birthday. And the reason that stood out to me is because thinking of the card parting gifts, I never thought of the theme of that card at all. But now I think it's actually a cool theme card, which is, you know, that card is an event that lets you transfer all the resources from one hero to another, which is, you know, exactly what's happening with a hobbit's birthday party where they're giving away all their stuff.
Yeah, it's cool.
You know, their resources to someone else. So,
mm-hmm.
Cool theme card.
But we need a better card to represent hobbit gluttony besides Second Breakfast. Because that card, I can't even remember what it does. It just like lets you get an attachment out of your discard pile. Wasn't that it?
Yeah, it brings back an attachment.
Yes, so there's got to be something better than that, but I guess
good
that...
Good meal. Isn't there a good meal? Make stuff cost
less. Oh, yeah, there you go. I almost forgot about a good meal, yeah. So there is a little bit of an homage to Hobbit eating habits. One thing I'd like to figure out how to do is play up their art of disappearing, especially as it pertains to relations. Like, whenever the Sackville Bagginses show up, like, they just are trying to get rid of them. So there are already so many Hobbit cards that allow you to avoid engagements and things like that. But what if there was something where it's like, you know, after you play a Hobbit ally, choose a Hobbit hero, that Hobbit hero just, you know, cannot be attacked or cannot exhausted to defend, like that kind of thing, just to show them scampering off when an unexpected visitor or unwelcome relation shows up at their door.
I love the implication, like, I want to say it's Mary tells Frodo at one point that he knows about, I mean, I might be skipping ahead, but it's just funny that, like, one of the ways that Mary discovers that the ring exists is he witnesses Bilbo using it to hide from the Sackville Bagginses, which I think is hilarious. Yeah. Like, it's the most powerful artifact in all of Middle-earth, and Bilbo uses it to avoid his, you know, essentially his, like, unwanted in-laws or whatever.
That's so funny. Very Hobbity. All right, so the party goes on. Mr. Baggins runs away. Frodo gives away a bunch of his stuff. And a worried Gandalf runs away and comes back several years later. Which this is something that... So my history with the books is this. I tried reading Fellowship before the films came out. I didn't quite make it. Then after the movies came out and I read The Hobbit and I got more into it, I became a rabid fan of the books. But even when I read this... The films were so embedded in my brain that I had a hard time wrapping my head around the timeline. So after the party, Gandalf goes away for, it's like 2 years or several months, and he checks in like every year for something like 9 years, and then he's gone away for another score of years, and then he finally comes back. And all that time when he's away, we learn about what he was doing, but I think that's something that can get lost really easily is just the fact that literally 18 years pass, or more than that. No, 18 years between, is that right? Between the long expected party and then Frodo's final departure. But when Gandalf does finally come back, we get the whole shadow of the past, where Gandalf explains both to Frodo and to us as readers the significance of the ring, a little bit of the history of the ring, and why. Really sets up the whole adventure and why we should care about it. But before then, we cannot go any further without talking about the namesake card, the Shadow of the Past. Is there a less useful card? Maybe the End Comes might be the runner-up for that one. Yeah. Merlant.
No.
So we got,
No, I don't remember what Shadow Pass does. Oh, yeah, that is such a such an odd card.
Takes the top card of the encounter discard pile.
Because you can use it situationally to like set stuff up and kind of manipulate the encounter.
Sure, it's expensive too, though. I mean, like you know, when you miss out on Tom Bombadil in Old Forest or something, that's always frustrating. Or in this newest quest, the Gen Con quest, if you discard the objective attachment that you need or whatever, you might want to move it. But my God, I don't want to pay two for it. It's very odd.
Yeah, it has
I almost wonder what was in their head. Like, why did they design this in the Mirkwood cycle? Like, what did they think we needed to get Gollum, I guess? I don't know.
A clue, maybe like a discarded clue in the Hunt for Gollum?
Yeah.
Move the top card of the encounter discard pile to the top of the encounter deck.
It's kind of thematic. I mean, it just, yeah, it's a little overcost and doesn't quite...
Yeah, there was some stuff in the... I can't remember the mechanics off the top of my head, but maybe it was Athelas? Was that?
Yeah, that would be helpful.
I don't remember.
But that card came with Return to Mirkwood, so it was like several packs later. But that would be helpful, you know, if you discarded Athelas and the...
I mean, you're getting the pass back. I mean, I guess it fits the name, but I don't know if it fits much else. It's odd.
Yeah, but I wonder if, you know, trying to think of a way that this theme could be carried up, pulled off in a more helpful approach. You know, the whole idea is that Gandalf is informing Frodo of the past to equip him for the journey ahead. So I wonder if it would be, you know, I don't know, what, like pick an enemy type. If that enemy is revealed off the encounter deck, they get X, Y, and Z happens, you know, kind of like you're prepared for the arrival of certain nasties. I don't know. It is very tricky. When we get into stuff like this, I tend to admire the developers more and more.
I almost feel like the victory display mechanics, that is what it's doing, even though it doesn't have this theme of Shadow of the Past, like... the theme is around, like, you know, you've encountered this enemy before, so Rossio, the new hero, is ready for it.
That's true.
He experienced this location before, so she knows how to deal with future force, that kind of thing.
Right.
What I think is interesting, you mentioned the big time gap, which is not in the movies, but is in the books, and that time gap is important because that is the period during which the main game takes place, this game that we know. So in many ways, this game that we love is pretty much the answer to the question, like, what the hell were they doing for those 17, 18 years? Because it seems like such a big time span, especially to our modern world where, you know, time moves a bit differently than this kind of, like, you know, medieval type world we're thinking of. And it's like 17 years, that's a freaking eternity. Like, how long does it take to figure out what's happening with the ring? And, you know, I've even seen people criticize that, like, it's not realistic, like, Gandalf is so smart, he should have figured it out, you know, in shorter time, and why did he leave Frodo alone for 17 years? But I think, you know, it's a different world. There's a lot of stuff going on, as we see in our game. They're gallivanting around Middle Earth, so take some time.
Yeah, and within that time is when actually Sauron figures out what's going on. When Gollum finally works up the courage to leave the mountain and traverse Mirkwood, and well, I guess that would have happened before the party, but it's that whole time period, you know, just like you said, where we have the hunt for Gollum, we're trying to help Aragorn track down Gollum, and then of course the Dead Marshes and that whole Mirkwood cycle. But that's where a lot of action takes place, and really where, like I said, Sauron figures out what's going on, because were it not for Gollum, he wouldn't know to look for hobbits. He wouldn't know that the ring was even around. So, in a way, it's almost like giving time for internally for the story to work itself out and for the world to kind of catch up to what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's important for people to remember, because it's funny that there's some criticisms of the like, quote-unquote plot holes in Tolkien, and this is definitely one of them, of the whole, like, how could Gandalf, who's a Maiar and was sent to Middle-earth specifically to protect against Sauron and yada yada yada, how could he not know that? But the fact that the Dark Lord, the creator of the ring itself, did not even know that the ring still existed,
right,
like, should give you an idea that everyone at this point has long since assumed, oh, it's lost, it'll never be found again. So it's not really on Gandalf that he didn't immediately assume that this magical ring that Bilbo brings back from his adventures would be the ring of power. That would be kind of a crazy leap to make. And that's why even when he has suspicions, he doesn't just assume, like, oh, my suspicions must be correct. He goes and researches and tries to get to the bottom of it to figure it out, because that's not the kind of leap you just want to make blindly and say, oh, yeah, of course it's the ring of power.
Yeah, and that's like, you think about the sheer time scale of like 3,000 years passing from the ring being lost until now, like, do we know the location of some pharaoh's lost ring in ancient Egypt? Like, do we know where that is? Like, yeah, the One Ring is important, but even with our modern technology, think about all the stuff we don't know about 3,000 years ago. Granted, they have elves who are actually alive there, which is a bit of an advantage, admittedly, but, you know, it's still a lot of time that, yeah, it's I think people are kind of underestimate like how difficult it would be in that situation to really know what's going on.
Yeah, and there's one other really important thing from a narrative standpoint, which is that Tolkien establishes pretty early on that the ring is essentially its own character in the story. And he talks about the ring, and Gandalf will be one of the people that talk about the ring as though it has its own motivations, right? It'll like, and he mentions very early on that like it'll grow and it'll shrink depending on if it wants to slip off someone's finger. It wanted to slip off of Isildur's finger after he left the Gladden Fields and was, you know, ambushed by orcs. It wanted him to be found because it didn't want to be taken by men and held or whatever. It had its own motivations. And so in that sense, it's really like, it's almost like, I've always interpreted it this way, that the ring wanted to be lost for as long as it was. Like that it had its own reasons for, you know, for doing that. And then eventually then it wants to be found. And there's this, like it creates an interesting element to the story of that you have this incredibly powerful magical artifact that has its own motivation that is not necessarily that of the one who wears it.
Right. Its motivation is to, it's almost parasitic in a sense, because it's going to take over whoever has it.
Yeah.
And that's one thing that I constantly think about that I cannot get my brain around, that I just have to chalk up to magic, that you have to chalk up to magic, is where the inherent power of the ring itself is because, as Gandalf says, he let his essence or like his power into the ring. And you think, like, how does that even work? Like, you know, and even not even thinking practically, how would you make something like that, but how does it play out? And it's just as you're saying, the ring becomes a character. It becomes almost like a mini Sauron, kind of encased in this ring. And again, there's no way to think about it other than just magic, like the Mirror of Galadriel. But it really is like a little bit of Sauron, you know, hanging around a chain in Bilbo and Frodo's pocket.
Yeah.
One thing that's interesting is that even the hobbits know about Mordor. Gandalf says it's, you know, like shadows on the edge of old dreams, but it talks about how in this lull between the party and the shadows of the past, that the dwarves are passing through seeking refuge, and then even the hobbits hear about things going on in the land of Mordor, which speaks to what you're talking about, is the speed and tempo of communication at, you know, pre-industrial times. And our game can't really do this as specifically, but in the One Ring role-playing game, there's specific mention of the narrative timing of this kind of thing, of almost a Dark Age kind of world, where it could be years before you hear about something happening. So the fact that news is trickling all the way to the Shire gives us some indication of how late in the game things are getting. And Gandalf says as much when he's talking to Frodo.
The eagles or the butterflies or the moths could have told you much more quickly.
I know. If only those eagles would stop being so selfish.
It is. I mean, just to take the other side, and I'm not going to be that articulate because I don't actually care, but 18 years is, like, why not one? Why not two? Why not five? 18... 20 freaking years. I mean, that's a long time for anyone to sort of figure out what's going on. Is it a plot hole to me? No. Is it something if I stopped and thought about it, it'd be like, oh, that's kind of a while. I mean, maybe, yeah. The cartoon Lord of the Rings accounts for it. They quickly show the seasons flashing on the screen for how long it's been. But yeah, you're right. The Jackson movies don't. But I don't know if it, at the end of the day, really matters. Right? Because if no one... I mean, true, it's been 60 years since The Hobbit, or give or take, and then you add on another 20, so it's 80 years or so that Gollum's been running around doing whatever, and then he finally gets caught. I mean, like, I guess if you think if it's been 80 years, that's kind of weird. But, it still doesn't bother me all that much that it's a long time period.
I agree, it is weird. I suspect that Tolkien honestly did it because he needed certain things to line up, chronologically speaking. That, like, he wanted, you know, and it's really, it's interesting, and this is a little bit later, so I don't know, like, you know, spoiler alert, but there's stuff that happens around the Council of Elrond where, you know, Frodo is talking to Gloin and kind of hearing about what else has been happening in the north. And it's really interesting that it's almost like Gloin's giving him a breakdown of like, oh, this happened, this happened, this happened. Here's, you know, like, and it kind of sets up everything that's going on in Wilderland at that time. And it kind of makes me feel like Tolkien wanted to have certain things be at a certain point before the events of the War of the Ring set off. So it does feel a little bit contrived on the one hand, but on the other hand, if that's what he needed to do to have all the characters that he wanted in play for the War of the Rings be the ones that were in play, then so be it.
One of the cool things that we get, because you mentioned Derek, about how they hear in the Shire of, you know, these events happening far off, and, you know, you start getting the elven, like, kind of refugees coming through, sylvan refugees. and also they mentioned these strange dwarves of far countries, which attracted my interest because we know almost nothing of, like, the far eastern dwarves who live way out far east that they could turn into cards at some point.
Do you think they meant farther east in the Iron Hills?
I do. It could be read in a few ways. I think so. I they were emphasizing the distance. So, I mean, it could just be the Iron Hills, but maybe they were coming from even farther off, which would be...
Well, that would make sense, because be kind of cool. Because it seems like the Iron Hills and the Lonely Mountain are still pretty secure.
Right.
So, but we know that lots of crap's going down way east, so I guess it would kind of make sense that dwarves from far, far away would be heading west to get out of the mess.
Because they mention wars happening, which could be... They could be just talking about kind of the border skirmishes around Gondor and that whole thing, which they probably do. It could just be the way that tales kind of grow in the telling as they spread. But it could also be, I like to think that maybe there were big wars out east for control as Sauron was trying to kind of consolidate control over those peoples, and maybe some of them were fighting, maybe the Blue Wizards were there, and so... There were probably tons of people coming from out east trying to escape all that conflict. But there's a lot that we don't know that's kind of interesting and that could, you know, turn into cards at some point.
Man, there's a whole cycle waiting to happen. Hurry up, finish the first stage. You can get on that. And then we get more wonderful Hobbit banter that has graduated a generation. It's no longer... the old Miller and Gaffer Gamgee, but it's Ted Sandyman and Sam Gamgee getting into it. And Sam makes his wonderful comment about his cousin Hal seeing a tree man, which, you know, I don't know if we're going that way to the northern end of the Shire and beyond in the game, but it would be cool to maybe have some kind of objective ally that we have to talk to, some stray ent that we need to convince to join our cause.
Yeah, it's not just a wandering end. It's a way far away end.
Lost. Drunken hangover lost end.
How did I get here? Too much end drought.
Irma thought that it might have been an ent wife, actually.
Yeah.
That was her thought when we were reading that together.
Yeah. I love the little, these teeny little hooks that are all over. They're just like little booby traps throughout the whole text that you can extrapolate on.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things Tolkien was really good at, is just giving us these little hints. Some of them get expanded on later and some of them don't, and you're just left to wonder about it. But yeah, I really like that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact quote from the letter, but he said something to the effect of it's very important to leave, or the idea of something mysterious in the background is very effective, and it's even more effective if there's actually a story to it. So that's why I think... you know, Gandalf mentions Ancalagon the Black, and obviously there are many, many other references to the Elder Days. So it's hard to imagine in a post-Silmarillion world, post-Wiki world for that matter, what an original reader would say, like, what is Ancalagon the Black? Who is Eärendil? Who is, you know, Beren and Lúthien? So I think we get a bit of that as when we first read these stories, or even from the films you get little drops of it. But it's very cool that even the... A tree man, after we learn about Treebeard and the Entwives, all of a sudden there's this whole depth and layers of meaning to it that and lots of possibilities.
The other thing that stood out in this chapter to me is obviously the issue of rings and the ring, because we get our first look at ring lore. And we really only have the one ring in the game, and we have kind of the two of the elven rings so far. Of course, the dwarven rings... Gandalf says they've all been consumed by dragons and or recovered, and the nine are of course, you know, hanging out with the Nazgul. Yeah, but he does mention there are kind of lesser elven rings floating around, and, you know, those could become cards. And one of the things, I don't know how it would fit into this game, it probably wouldn't, but was really cool in the Middle-earth CCG is there would be kind of these, like, generic golden rings or whatever rings, and you would have to test them to see whether it was the one ring or not, and that's basically what happens in this chapter, obviously, with throwing the ring in, so... I don't know, it would be cool to have, like, some kind of lesser elven ring in that you could attach and then somehow test it, and I don't know if it would turn out to be the one ring, but I don't know. It was just a cool mechanic that would that could turn into something.
Yeah, I always really liked that, because it captured that sense of, I have this thing, I know it's powerful, I don't know how powerful it is, I don't know, it's kind of like a, you know, opening a present at Christmas where yeah. you might get something small, draft or you pack. Might get something really big, and you don't really, huh?
Or a draft pack.
Sure. That's funny that you mentioned that, because of the draft, like, someone would open a pack and be like, this pack is crap, and then they'd get past the next pack and they're like, oh my gosh, I won everything. And I'm like, this is why draft is fun. They can't all be winners, right? Some of them have to be duds, so the good ones feel that much better.
Yep, there's only one ring. But that is the one advantage that role-playing games have over a card game, is the ability to you know, have these more generic trinkets and attachments. But I think they could definitely pull off, even if it just was a non-unique elven ring, and it provided some kind of, maybe if it was like a zero cost, and it provided, you know, just a small bonus to defense or attack or something, almost like the signals do, but maybe specifically for elves or for somebody else. So there's something there that they could play around with. But again, we don't know that much about the rings that stuck around and who's got them and who's don't. I don't know if Glorfindel's got, like, you know, a ring on each finger.
Bling, man. He's all about the bling.
He has beautiful golden hair. He doesn't need rings. Let me go ahead and get this tangent over with. One gripe I have with the Jackson films is the handling of the defeat of Sauron after the siege at the very beginning, when they're depicting what happened at the end of the Second Age. And how Sauron just shows up and starts wrecking stuff. Now, that's very cool visually, but the duel between Gil-galad, Elendil, and Sauron should have been the most epic opening to any movie ever, but instead, we don't even see Gil-galad, and then Elendil gets smashed, and then his son desperately hacks off the finger by accident. So I think that with all of our choreography and computer animation, a duel between the three of them would have been off the charts awesome, alas, we did not get to see that.
Because clearly the right move for Sauron there was to reach down with his hand.
I'm going to grab you.
Smashing into pieces with his freaking hammer.
Yeah. Because as Gandalf describes it to Frodo, he says, it was Gil-galad, Elven King, and Elendil of Westeros who overthrew Sauron, though they themselves perished in the deed. So the two of them managed to beat Sauron into submission, but then they succumbed to their wounds afterwards. So,
which is a huge okay, maybe for movie watchers it's not a huge difference, in the grand scheme it's probably not a huge difference, but thematically there's a huge difference between saying that these two dudes were strong enough to defeat Sauron with him wearing the ring, just conventionally, they didn't use any special tricks, they were able, just the force of arms, and they were just that strong and cunning or whatever else to beat him. But what's kind of stressed in the Lord of the Rings is that power is now lost, and there's no one alive, even Aragorn or Gandalf, who can stand against them, and so they have to resort to destroying the ring. Versus in the movies, what they're saying is, you know, it's always that way. If Sauron has the ring, the only way you're going to beat him is through cutting off that ring or some kind of, you know, special trickery. Again, maybe not the biggest difference if you're making a movie, but there is a thematic difference there.
Yeah, and I think it's a good example, and there's a lot of them in the narrative, of you can never quite trust the narrator or whoever's telling you a given story, right? So that, like, you have this sense that what we mentioned at the top, where this whole thing is being translated or being retold from a book that someone wrote down. So if one person tells you, oh, you know, Gil-galad and Elendil themselves were able to overcome Sauron, that doesn't mean that it is actually true. It just means that in the retelling of that epic battle, that's the way it's being told. You know, who know? There's no way to know how desperate it truly was. And it never bothered me that Sauron would be there with the ring, because that to me always spoke to his arrogance. You know, he assumed that he was unbeatable.
I'm sticking with mine.
You know, regardless of how in danger he was or was not against, you know, Gil-galad and Elendil, he just assumed, oh, I can take all comers. I can defeat everyone.
We also learn a great deal about Sméagol, which, again, I keep coming back to the films because those images are so firmly embedded in my psyche, but that opening to The Return of the King where we learn about Sméagol and Deagle was really, really well done. And the story is told here by Gandalf, and we learn about the contrast between the deceitfulness of the acquisition of the ring. So Sméagol claims it's his birthday present, even though he had to kill his friend to get it on his birthday, and how Bilbo originally lied about it being handed over to him very graciously by Gollum after he bested him in the riddle contest, which of course was not the right thing. So it's very, very interesting. And then that kind of goes along with our first, for this episode, our first listener submitted card, The Pity of Bilbo. Who sent this one in, Ian?
This was Chad G, who was also at Gen Con.
Awesome. Tell us about that card, please. The Pity of Bilbo.
Okay, so Pity of Bilbo is a one-cost lore attachment, a condition attachment, attached to a hobbit hero. And the combat action is, after an enemy has been destroyed, exhaust the Pity of Bilbo, an attached hero, to cancel the damage. Then, look at the top card of the encounter deck. If attached hero is Bilbo, look at the top three cards.
That's really cool, because Bilbo's Act of Mercy, which again was very much emphasized in the films, kind of lays the groundwork for the eventual destruction of the ring. And so I kind of like that. Just getting to peek at the encounter deck is almost like glimpsing into the future, all because of Bilbo's Act of Pity.
Yeah, and I think it's cool that it plays off of keeping enemies around, because generally in this game you have no incentive to keep enemies around, just, you know, knock them down as soon as they pop up.
Yeah.
So it would be cool to get some cards that kind of, I guess some of the new Dúnedain stuff does that, where you get incentive for keeping enemies around for the first time, but it'd be cool to get some things in that, since that is a huge theme in the book, this idea of pity that, you know, you don't always just mercilessly kill the enemy.
And it goes in with one of Gandalf's quotes, which when Frodo says, you know, it's a pity that Bilbo didn't kill him, and Gandalf tells him, you know, don't be so hasty to pass death as a sentence to others. You know, it's I should pull it up so I can quote it exactly, because it really is a beautiful quote. Definitely one of my favorites of Gandalf's. Many that live deserve death, and some that die deserve life. Can you give it to them? Then do not be too eager to deal out death and judgment.
Yeah, I mean, we're totally going like literature book club here with themes and stuff, but it's cool. But another huge theme in Tolkien, I think, is the issue of pride and kind of arrogance. And I think that's what touches on there is, you know, even if you think you're on the side of the good guys, you shouldn't have the pride and arrogance to think that you have the right to kind of determine the fate of others, because that is really the path to evil. Once you think you have the right, whether you think you're righteous or not, to kind of decide the destiny of other people.
Yeah, domination is something that keeps coming back, and that's one way that Galadriel seems to distinguish her magic and elven magic against dark magic, is that dark magic is meant to coerce people and to dominate them. And it's the same, and that comes up again in Tolkien's letters and things like that, where even his view of allegory was disdainful, because when you're writing an allegory and there's only one interpretation, you're dominating the reader's understanding of your work, whereas he used the term application. So people have all kinds of ways to interpret The Lord of the Rings, but what they're really doing is finding ways to apply the story to the way they see the world. So that's interesting, both internally and externally of the story. Well, I'm wearing out, so what are some closing points here?
I guess kind of the big closing question that I would say is, we've kind of touched on these big themes. Like, do we think that the game itself kind of bears out these themes at all?
It's not really a lot of room for mercy, like you were saying, with orcs.
Yeah.
Well, or eating and partying, right? I mean, I think this is going to be the hardest part of the books to actually adapt to the game, because at its heart, this game is about fighting. It's martial, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, there's very few quests that do not involve. I can't think of any that don't involve killing enemies as part of winning.
It's gonna lie to us to make some, or fall to us to make some custom scenarios about drinking, killing beers instead of.
Yeah, well, see, and you joke, but I have to say one of my favorite parts of Gen Con is playing. Playing Hobbit Tales while enjoying a tasty adult beverage is quite a fun game, I have to say. Don't knock it till you've tried it.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think it's kind of a point that I always bring up, so hopefully I'm not being repetitive, but I think the Middle-Earth CCG, one of the things it did really well was delving into the idea of corruption, and if you do try to dominate and aspire to power, it does have the chance of biting you. We've seen that in this game mainly through the Doom keyword, but it is something I always want this game to explore more, because it is a huge theme. Like, if you try to dominate, if you try to get too much power, it will harm you. And so it would be cool to see more cards that are kind of double-edged swords that give you a ton of power, but they also have the capability to, somehow turn you to evil, or somehow just end up causing the quest to fail.
Yeah, that's cool. Going back to what I was just saying about coercion and how Tolkien was against that, I'm flipping back through and looking at this bit towards the end. You know, Matthew, you talked about comic relief at the beginning, where at the end of this long, horrible discussion between them about how the world's coming to an end if Frodo doesn't do something, Gandalf pulls Sam up by the ear, and all of a sudden he's shoved off onto the quest with him. So it'd be cool if there was maybe an event card, if you were playing the Gandalf hero, that you'll call it the Will of Gandalf or something, where you got to take control of somebody else's allies or multiple allies, or you basically got to make your playing partner do what you wanted them to do, in kind of this way that Gandalf does, though in a much more subtle way. So that, you know, maybe if you had Gandalf, you could threaten to turn somebody into a toad and throw them into a garden full of snakes, and you could then take control of their deck for a minute.
Alternatively, if they do something that you like, you can make their beer fantastic for 7 years.
Good old barley, man.
That is just amazing. That does bring up another point too that I forgot that I wanted to mention quickly, which that Gandalf does mention how he gets that information from Gollum is, I forgot the exact phrasing, but something about
fear of fire.
Yeah, fear of fire, and questioning him sternly, and I'm like, did Gandalf torture Gollum?
He fireboarded that Mamma Jamma.
Like, because he said question.
Enhanced interrogation, I believe, is what the Istari prefer to call it, Ian. It's enhanced interrogation.
Oh, man, there's a big scandal going to come out of this one.
The Istari do not torture.
That's so funny.
That is their stated, that is their public statement on the matter.
But I guess they could even tie back to fireworks, right? Because if Gandalf can manipulate fire because of the ring, then he could somehow use it in a, you know, a loving way to get Smeagol to talk.
Yeah.
I can see it on BuzzFeed tomorrow. 10 things you didn't know about Gandalf that will shock you.
I thought he was a nice wizard until he said this.
Death by sled bunnies. We're rabbits, rather. Rusty rabbits.
Oh, man.
You see my friend Radagast over there? He can't always control those rabbits.
See, I was trying to stay away from the movies, because earlier, Derek, when you said, like, one of the things that bothers you about the movie, it just, in my mind, it popped, like, oh, only one? Because the more that I go back and read the book, I realize, like, oh, the book is so good, and the movie gets so many things wrong.
Which kind of goes, there's a whole book about that called Through a Screen Darkly, where the guy kind of concludes that Jackson just seemed to, and his whole writing team seemed to have a couple of misconceptions about the book itself.
Like fundamental misconceptions?
Yes, exactly, and that kind of informed some of the odd decision-making that went on, but that's neither here nor there. We already had our big Hobbit discussion about the movie. All right, well, anything else, gentlemen, before we conclude this fine addition to the book club? I'm going to go ahead and give us a collective pat on the back, because this was... these are great chapters, but they're not exactly the best fodder for gaming discussion, because not a lot happens. So I think we'll get into a lot more when we get to the subsequent chapters.
Yeah, I look forward to the more exciting stuff. I think that'll be quite a bit more relevant to the game.
Yeah, and we'll actually get to compare for the first time how the material got adapted into an actual quest. So that should be interesting.
Well, this has been episode 29 of the Grey Company Podcast, brought to you by our patrons. Special thanks to Brandon, Michael, and Eugene, our latest patron hobbitry in arms. Thank you, guys. If you enjoy what we do on the show and would like to support us with a few bucks an episode, head over to patreon.com/grayco to sign up. And you can, of course, sometimes get entered into very special giveaways, which we had our giveaway winner for the Ruins of Belagos last week. As always, you can find us online, and we encourage you to stop by our website at greatcompanypodcast.com, and from there, you can link to all of our various social media outlets and converse with us and tell us what an unfunny job we're doing. Please send your emails to thegreatcompanypodcast@gmail.com. We would love to read your questions and comments on the air and your custom cards for our next book club. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Good night.
Night.
Man, my microphone's picking up the fan, but it's too hot to turn the fan off. Oh, well.
Yeah, exactly.
That's life in the South, my friend.
Yeah, it's finally starting to cool.
I'm not turning my fan off either.
Mm-mm-mm. Okay.
I really don't want to hear it.
Yeah, we live in the South. He lives in f***ing Mordor. All right.
I think even Mordor would be like, Phoenix, I'll pass.
Like, all just right. Throw it in Phoenix. You don't have to go to the tracks.
Shortcut.
All right, ready when you are, Matthew.
All right.